Hey you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and in this old podcast, me and Keith Gat, Keith the Boy, Dirty Keith, the Big K.
I've never had a nickname before until I started doing a podcast. I never like 10.
I know. I don't think I've ever even given you a nickname, and I've known you for 30 years. But you know, now you get a few. Yeah, our hashtag friends of Keith, as some people say online. We've got a few. When people are always asking about you, it was hashtag friends of Keith. So you've got a lot of friends out there, it seems.
No real friends, though.
No, just me.
Yeah, just you, just the one. And yeah. That's enough.
Well, you get a lot of people enjoyed that picture I put up on Instagram of us in the...
the old Batman and Robin costume.
Yeah, the Batman and Robin costume. Yeah. Me doing the face. Yeah.
The classic Mike face.
Yeah, it's a good-ass picture.
That's a great photo.
Yeah.
I had to do a bit of digging to get that out, but I have it up my office now. Pride placement right in the middle.
Yeah, it's a good ass picture. I know. I need to get a copy of that too. But what you call it? Yeah. So we're recording. sorry, I just got a zone out.
Your phone.
There. Yeah. No, I just was like, I was on my phone. I was like, actually,
I started off as a fake yawn, turned into a very.
It actually turned into real. So yeah, folks, wherever you are, we're in the depths of winter right now. So, you know what that means. We got to talk about some murder. Mm-hmm. Today, we got a good one. It's a oldie but a goldie. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Before we get into this, how are you? How are you today? I'm talking to the listener, yet not you. So I can see Keith opening his mouth, getting ready to answer. Like, shut up. Just I don't care. Yeah. Shut up, Keith. You know, whatever you're doing, daytime, nighttime. Maybe, you know what? Maybe you're listening to this months from now and it's summer and, you know. Yeah. So my winter references won't make sense to you at all.
How is the future? Let us know.
Yeah, exactly. Send us a postcard. Yeah. But Keith, how are you?
Good. I've been dying to talk to you.
I know. Yeah. You've had this. So for the folks at home, it's the mic zone. And Keith has been hinting at this story, and I'm very excited to hear it. It's he's got another good one from his house, his haunted house. So just to sum up, so far you have two possibly dead bodies in your attic, or at least two people died there, or it has two people's essentially homemade gravestones in your attic.
Yeah, there's names inscribed into the wall with RIP the same day, year. 1913, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, it's like almost 90 to 100 years ago is when it's believed they died. Mm-hmm. You can find no records of these people.
Can't find anything, yep.
The neighbors have no clue what the fuck you're talking about.
Nope.
You did some research. You went to the library even?
I even went to the library.
You did. You hit the bricks.
Yeah, I went to the library, the genealogy thing? Yeah. Went on to that, paid for it. And tried to find
you're even putting your own money into this.
I know, right? Can't find that. Yeah, find that and about the names. So
that's number one. Red flag number one of these two mysterious people who may or may not have died in the house or may or may not be buried in your attic. Then you have had just creepy shit happen in the house. Mm. For example, a moth has flown into your mouth. Mm-hmm. You've seen handprints on the windows, which may or may not be. That's kind of like an iffy one.
That's an iffy one, yeah.
You have found a baseball in this attic.
That's very
which
true.
Which is haunted, which just randomly appeared there one day. It looked like it's been there for a long time.
Yeah.
You heard a ghostly toddler say, "Mama."
Yep. That happened. That was very real.
Yeah. What, you don't think that was real?
No. Beforehand, it was kind of like, it got real for me then.
Okay. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so just like, I just want to clarify, like, you are not bullshitting. Like, you're not just like, oh, this is something to talk about. Because I've asked Keith this question off mic, is like, are you just, you know, kind of making this something for the podcast? It's like, no, this is real shit that's happened. Because Keith messages me about this, and not in relation to what we talk about on the podcast.
Yeah, like if nothing happens, then I don't bring it up because I don't control it.
But,
this one particular thing, I've been dying to talk
this
about
is,
it.
Yeah, exactly. So Keith had messaged me during the week saying some weird shit went down, and he wouldn't tell me because he was like, I'll tell you on the podcast.
Yeah.
So now we're on the podcast.
Now I'm going to tell it.
Okay, I'm excited.
Okay, so let me set the scene. So it was the morning time, and we were downstairs. We were getting ready to leave the house. Myself, my wife, and my daughter. And
getting ready to leave the house for like school. It was like a work day, like a Monday to Friday.
Yeah. So my wife was getting ready to go to work. I work from home, so I was just helping to get out of the house. And we're getting my daughter off to creche or what do you call it in the States? Preschool.
Preschool, kindergarten, creche, whatever.
Yeah. So we're getting ready to leave the house. It was still quite dark still because it was early morning and it's the winter, so it was dark. We were at the front door. We're kind of getting our shoes. They were getting their shoes and their coats on. Then the handle of the front door just went down slowly. And myself and my wife just looked at it and were like, who's at the front door? It's really weird. So I opened the front door real quick and there was no one there. And my daughter was there and she's like, oh, who's there? And my wife, she was like, oh, it was just the wind. But then she looked at me and goes, what the fuck was that? And she's quite skeptical.
Yeah.
So she's like, what the hell was that?
So, the door locked?
The door's locked, yeah. But you can still move the handle open.
Right, and is it like a hard to move handle? Like, is it a heavy handle? Or?
So, I didn't record the incident, but this is how the handle sounds. Just, it's a heavy handle. So, okay. This is how you get an idea of...
Play it into the mic, yeah.
The weightiness of this handle.
It's got a good latch to it.
It's got a good latch. It's heavy. It wouldn't. And when they left the house, my wife was like, "What the hell was that?" And I was like,
okay, "Shitting yourself."
I'll tell you what it is. That's goddamn content.
I wish I'd recorded it. Yeah.
But she left, and after I was messing around with the locks, like maybe there's something wrong with the mechanism. Maybe it wasn't down properly. I messed with it for about like 15-20 minutes after, and I couldn't get it to do the same thing. But when I did open the door, what's also weird is when I did open the door and there was no one there, at the very end of our garden was that black cat again.
Oh.
Just sitting at the end of the garden looking at us. And now you're thinking, oh, the cat jumped up and doing the handle. But we have like a frosted glass on the front of our... Uh-huh. And I didn't see Anton jump up or at the handle. So you can kind of vaguely see out the front.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't see Anton. We just seen and heard the handle slowly go down.
I imagine you would have heard if a cat had jumped up as well. It's not like the cat would have sat on it and slowly.
It would have jumped up.
Like, yeah. Poof, yeah.
And it would have been a lot quicker.
Yeah.
It would have been jumped up, grab it, and kind of pull it down. Where this was a slow handle pull
that
down.
The Keith, they're coming in.
Or leaving for work.
Or he's out. All right, see you later.
Bye.
Have a great day.
But yeah, no, it was freaky. Really, really strange.
That's weird.
Really real. And especially for my wife to get like freaked out by it.
Yeah.
Like, because she's, like I said, she's quite skeptical of these things. And even her was like, okay, I can't explain that. That was weird. But very, very strange.
Yeah, that's a chilly one. That is that's a spook. That's a spookster.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those moments I could feel, you know, they can feel the blood drain out of you.
Yeah, oh hell yeah.
Got the chills, man. Like, oh, what the hell was that?
I co-signed that to the fullest extent, my man. That sounds terrifying.
Oh man, I've been dying to tell you about that.
Okay, that is a good one. Yeah, hell yeah, man. That's a good one.
I'll keep you updated to let you know if anything else weird happens.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what could be. No chance. It was the cat. No chance, man.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, because I could see, you can somewhat, like it's frosted glass, but you can see shapes.
Yeah.
And it's where the handle is. So I would have seen something, and it's a black cat, so I would have seen something black jump up at it, or as I said, it would have been a quick pull down.
Mm.
But no, just this slow lever going down, as if someone, I generally thought someone on the outside was just like pulling, I think that kind of freaked me out a bit more. It's like, why is someone in our garden trying to get in this hour in the morning, you know? But very weird, very strange.
All right, well, sleep well, folks at home. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Well, we actually have a whole story now we actually have to tell you, which is kind of related. It is about a murder house, which did kind of become a haunted house later on. It suits this episode.
Yeah, on topic.
Yeah, on topic. All right, let's give it a go. All right, let's get into it. So the town of Villasca, Iowa, is a strange one. In that usually when I tell you about these towns that used to be, you know, tiny but these days are huge, well, this one is the opposite, in fact. Villasca in the early 20th century was a thriving railroad town with a population of 2,500 people. These days, the southwest Iowa town is about half of what it used to be, sitting around 1,300 people in 2023. However, the event that would make Villasca famous, or infamous...
Oh, is it Villasca or Villisca?
Oh, Villisca, yeah. Sorry, I've been calling... What do I... I've been calling it Villasca? Oh, yeah, it's Villisca.
Just before you gotta...
before I say it a million more times. I don't know why I'm calling it Villasca. Yeah. Why the fuck did I call it Villasca?
Kind of like Alaska, but...
Yeah, all right. So every time I said Villisca, or every time I've said Villasca, folks, just pretend I said Villisca. Problem solved. So, however, the event that would make Villisca famous or infamous began at 7 a.m. on Monday morning, June 10th, 1912. The Titanic had sunk 2 months earlier, and World War I was 2 years away, and that was when Mary Peckham realized she hadn't seen any of her neighbors, the Moore family. This was very unusual to the elderly Mary. As the family were normally up at daybreak to do the morning chores and about the house at 501 East 2nd Street, and Mary would have seen them coming and going in the course of their duties. As I said, Villisca, it's a small town, and it's not very dense. Each house is a big enough garden. You'd see people coming and going all the time. Out of curiosity, more than concern, Mary knocked loudly on the Moore's door several times, but could not get any response from the family. Now, the Moore family was made up of Daddy Josiah, Mommy Sarah, and their four kids, Herman, Catherine, Arthur, and Paul, aged 11 to 5, a well-known gang about the town. Mary's concern grew, and she tried the door, but found it was locked up securely. After letting the family's chickens out of their coop, Mary decided that it would be best to call someone else and sent word to Ross Moore that the family were unreachable. Now, Ross was the town pharmacist, but he was also Daddy Josiah's brother, so he rushed from the pharmacy to his brother's home and also called out to his brother Josiah, but just like Mary, he could not get a response. Eventually, Ross decided to use his own copy of the Moore's house key to gain access, something he didn't want to do unless absolutely necessary. Trying to stave off panic, Ross let himself in. Mary waited on the Moore's porch as Ross made his way inside. After what Ross found, I'm sure she's more than happy she made that decision. Just off the parlor was a door to the guest bedroom, which Ross entered first. Inside, lying on the bed, were two bodies, but neither belonged to the Moore family. They were the bodies of 8-year-old Ina Stillinger and 12-year-old Lena Stillinger, two friends of Josiah and Sarah Moore's 9-year-old daughter, Catherine. The evening before the horrific crime took place, Sunday, June 9th, Josiah and Sarah had taken their four children to the day service at their church, which was three blocks from the house. The Stillinger girls were the children of the Moore's neighbors and had asked that they could stay the night at the Moore's house after the service. It was very much a last-minute change of plan that ended very murderously. The two young girls were covered by a sheet, but were also very clearly deceased, though it was not immediately obvious what had happened to them. Both girls' faces were badly beaten and drenched with blood, to the extent that the blood had soaked through the sheet and pooled under the bed. This was certainly no accident or remotely peaceful death. Ross exited the house and told Mary she needed to call Villisca's local marshal, Henry Hank Horton. Horton arrived shortly after, which was around 8:30, and found that the Stillinger girls had been bludgeoned to death. The grim findings didn't end there, with each room in the house searched, revealing a whole new horror. Strewn throughout the house were the six members of the Moore family who lived there. Each had been bludgeoned to death with an axe in the same vicious manner as the Stillinger sisters. The murder weapon? Josiah Moore's very own axe, normally found lying around in the backyard, having been found partially cleaned and propped up against the south wall of the guest bedroom, indicating that the Stillinger sisters had been killed last out of the eight total victims. When he exited the house, Hank told Ross that someone was murdered in every bed of the house.
Such a brutal way to go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, there's something about an axe murder that just resonates with people.
Yeah, it's such a dramatic. It's almost like a stereotype. This is probably where the stereotype comes from, but you know what I mean. It's like such a trope.
It's true, yeah. Like axe murders are relatively a rare occurrence,
mm-hmm.
but the use of axe murder is such a common expression in culture and media.
Mm.
Like it does, as you said, it obviously comes from these historical high profile cases because they've received such extensive media coverage. But I think why it captures the public attention so much is because, I guess, like, committing murder with this type of tool takes such intense rage and violent passion, and as I said, it's dramatic. So they don't just want to kill these people, they want to completely annihilate their existence.
That's exactly it. The early investigation established the murders as having taken place between midnight and 5 a.m. Josiah and Sarah Moore were likely the first to be killed, taken by surprise in their sleep after the killer, or killers, had waited for them to settle in bed after waiting for hours in the family's attic. See, later accounts claimed that cigarette butts were found in the attic, creating a theory that whoever was responsible had stalked their victims in the hours leading up to the killings, waiting till they were most vulnerable. Josiah and Sarah's deaths were the most brutal, standing out even in the bloody chaos of the multiple bodies. Sarah, interestingly, was the only victim to have been killed with the sharp face of the axe, though Josiah received the most blows. It's interesting the killer only used the sharp end of the axe on one person when you think the sharp end of the axe is that's supposed to be used.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Josiah's face had been so badly damaged from the repeated strikes, including one that left a dent in the ceiling from the killer swinging up the axe to rain it down on him, that his eyes appeared to be entirely missing. Moving from the master bedroom, the executions of the four more children followed. That was 11-year-old Herman, 9-year-old Catherine, 7-year-old Arthur, and 5-year-old Paul, and each were beaten to death with the blunt side of their father's axe that had minutes earlier been used on their parents. Though none of the children received as many blows as the parents, their deaths were no less brutal and barbaric, with every member of the family receiving at least 20 blows of the blunt edge of an axe, which is a lot of blows.
It's a lot. Like, the post-mortem of Josiah revealed that he'd been struck with the axe 30 times. And then, as you mentioned, he struck every other family member at least with 20 blows.
Which is like, that's exhausting.
It is exhausting. To do it to 8 people?
Yeah. Like, you imagine you couldn't even lift the axe up, like, after doing it, like, 40 times. Like, an axe is, like, heavy. This guy must have been really fucking strong.
That's it. Yeah, like, I don't know. Yeah, he just had so much rage, I guess. Just, yeah, crazy. Also, I don't know how he managed to get out of the attic and sneak around killing everyone without alarming anyone in the house.
That's the biggest thing I have in this case, is how did nobody else hear, nobody ran. Only one of the people, again, it's coming up, was found with defensive wounds on them.
Yeah.
And that was like the very last person. So 7 people had been killed before this person woke up.
Yeah.
You know, and we have people here sleeping in the same rooms, sleeping in the same beds.
That's it, yeah. Like, my house was built in the 1930s, and it's creaky as fuck. And this house was built in 1868. So, now, I initially thought that the killer might have drugged them to make them defenseless.
Yes, yeah.
However, when the doctors and the coroners arrived at the scene, they did an examination and found no trace of any type of anesthetic like chloroform or ethanol. Now, perhaps he managed to get them to ingest something beforehand, kind of like the case we covered about the, remember, the DeFeo family in Amityville?
That's what struck me in this one. That's the case I was thinking of, was the DeFeo, how he managed to murder everybody.
Yeah, but he drugged them by putting something in their evening meal.
Yeah.
But then, like, that kind of raises more questions about how did he manage to get drugs into their food?
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's really weird. Very strange, yeah.
The last anyone knew about the family was that they had been at church the day before. 39-year-old Sarah was a co-director of the church's Sunday school program. So the children and family, they were all very active in the church. The service, the day before, or the day of, they lost their lives, ended around 9:30 p.m., with most of the attendees and their parents hanging around after to socialize, eventually getting home around 9:45 and 10. Everyone said the family was in good spirits when they'd seen him that night, and then, well, this happened. To add some strangeness to the already sickening mystery, whoever had wiped out the Moore family that night had also gone from room to room around the whole house, covering mirrors and glass surfaces using items of clothing they'd taken from the Moore's own possessions, which is, like, it's really creepy.
Very weird.
I'd say it's got to do with, like, the killer couldn't bear to look at himself kind of thing.
I know, like, during, like, an Irish wake, we cover all the mirrors.
Do we? I've only ever been to, like, a handful of wakes in my life.
I've been to a few wakes, and the mirrors are, it's like a traditional thing to cover the mirrors. I think it's so the spirit of the dead person doesn't get trapped inside or something, but
wow.
I don't think that's something the killer cared about. I think it's more about what you're saying, that he was ashamed of what he was doing and didn't want to see himself. Like, he would have spent a good deal of time in that house. So it's likely that he killed each victim with a single blow and then went back to each body again to strike them with the blunt end of an axe multiple times while they were dead. So, very weird.
Yeah. They also added one last perplexing touch by taking a 4-pound slab of uncut bacon from the Moore's refrigerator in the kitchen and placing it down on the floor next to the badly cleaned murder weapon. On the Moore's kitchen table was a plate of uneaten food and a bowl of bloody water, which investigators took to have been a sign that the killer had sat down to clean themselves up and eat before leaving. But they had been interrupted or spooked by something and they left without finishing the food they'd set for themselves.
The bacon that was placed on the floor, it was also wrapped in a dish towel.
Okay.
So I've no idea what that was meant to symbolise. Maybe the original piglet blanket.
Mm.
But there is one theory about why it was done. So it was put forward by Iowa's Attorney General that the slab of bacon was used as a type of, I don't know how to put it lightly, sex toy.
Okay, he was fucking the meat.
Yeah, so it was used by the murderer while looking at Lena Stillinger. However, there was no hard proof of this. Pun intended.
Oh, yeah. Or soft proof. Very good. Okay. Wow. Okay. That's weird. But there you go.
I didn't come up with that
theory. Okay.
Blame the Attorney General.
Young Lena Stillinger was discovered with her nightgown raised up to her waist, and she had not been wearing any underwear, leaving her exposed. This led to the assumption that she may have been molested by the killer, and this could have been a motivating factor in the crime, but this was also quite easily ruled out, as the post-mortem investigation and analysis showed she hadn't been assaulted in that way, and, you know, the decision of the two Stillinger girls to stay over was made literally last minute. There's no way the killer would have known they were going to be in that house that night. If the killer was indeed hiding in the attic, as the cigarette butt suggested, the two girls, two Stillinger girls being there, the guests, that would have been a surprise to them. Though the autopsy did reflect a sad and disturbing fact, Lena was likely the only one to have been awake at the time of her murder. No one else showed defensive wounds, meaning they were taken by surprise and didn't have a chance to fight for their lives. Lena, however, had a blood stain on her knee and an apparent defensive wound on her arm, which showed she had at least for a moment attempted to fight off her attacker. All of the victims, the Moores and the Stillingers, had their faces covered with sheets or other impromptu coverings. As we said, yeah, it's pretty incredible no one heard the killings going on. 8 people murdered in a house. Only one person showed signs of being conscious. It's weird.
Yeah, well, vampires are pretty quiet, so.
They are pretty quiet. It only took minutes for news of the grisly find to spread around the local community. And within the hour, the house and officials were inundated with rubbernecking, you know, mouth-breathing bystanders who were trying to catch a glimpse of the carnage. To add insult to injury, the officials in charge of the scene thought it'd be a great idea to allow dozens of people access to the house in order to determine if any of them were the murderers. Hey, let's let everybody into the crime scene to see if they committed it. did you do this?
No, next.
Yeah, it's so fucking stupid. Not only did that insane idea prove worthless, it also contaminated the scene and any potential evidence is now useless. Contemporary estimates put the gathered crowds in the hundreds, many of whom took casual walks around the scene before National Guardsmen arrived at midday and finally cordoned off the house.
Yeah, it took like the guardsmen like 3.5 hours to show up, so yeah. it was a free for all until then.
Mm.
The town marshal, who was in charge, actually left the scene to go uptown to contact other officials, the state attorney general, request bloodhounds, all that kind of stuff. But this all had to be done by telegram. When he went uptown, he left inexperienced officers in charge of the crime scene who had like zero control over the crowd who, as you said, gathered in the hundreds. Then as they were trying to like peer in the window just to get a glimpse of what happened, the doctor who was examining the scene came out and said, "My God, boys, you don't want to go in there.
Yeah.
You will regret it for the longest day you live. You will always remember it." And then he just left.
Yeah.
So he basically kind of came out and said to a bunch of people with this morbid curiosity,
yeah,
like, "Wow, there's something crazy in there. Like, you'll never witness ever again."
Yeah, exactly.
And then left. Like, no wonder the officers couldn't control people that wanted to go in. But the people who went in, they contaminated the scene so badly. Some people were picking up and holding the axe that was used.
Jeez. Hey, check it out.
Pretty much, take a picture of me. Yeah. One person actually found a piece of Josiah's skull, about a square inch fragment.
Jesus.
And I took it home.
Jesus Christ.
So, honestly, the whole forensic side of this case, it was a shit show from the beginning. Even when the forensic expert, they got arrived on the second day, he was so drunk, he had to be helped off the train to be brought to a hotel where they tried to sober up for about 6 hours before he could get to work. So, yeah, not wow, a good start to the LA investigation here.
No, that didn't go well. The funeral for the Moore family and the Stillinger sisters took place just 2 days after they were found butchered, on June 12th, 1912. The murders were such big news that the streets were lined with thousands of residents. The numbers in attendance were so overwhelming for local authorities that they actually had to call in National Guardsmen to help block the streets for the 50-carriage funeral cortege on the way to the Villisca Cemetery for burial. At the time of the murders, Villisca was a city on the rise, and 43-year-old Josiah Moore, known to his friends as JB, was one of the most prominent and well-known businessmen in the area. Josiah was the owner and manager of the Moore Implement Company, which was a franchise of the much larger John Deere Company, which I'm sure most of you will have heard of. They make tractors, trailers, agricultural vehicles, all that kind of stuff. And his business was thriving despite stiff local competition. Josiah and Sarah had been married since December 6th, 1899, before the two went on to have their 4 children, Between Josiah's business dealings and Sarah's high standing in the church, the family were both well-known and well-liked in their social circles. There was little indication why anyone would want to hurt the family, and like many crimes at the time, the blame was quickly thrown on some kind of imaginary transient person who came in and is gone.
Some blow-in from town.
Yes, a blow-in, some filthy hobo or something. Yeah. It was a common thing at the time to put blame on an outsider rather than consider the possibility that they had such a person living among them. Something which authorities were keen not to refute, as it kept the community calm, thinking that the person had already moved on and allowing the police to get on with their investigation. There were reports of unrest in the community after the crime, with several locals even openly carrying weapons for fear they may become the next victim of the crazed Axeman. The investigation was hindered from the beginning, of course. Investigators had very little to go on, the house had been a shit show, and very few leads turned up in the days following. The murders began their own little industry in Villisca, with private investigators and news reporters coming in from the surrounding counties to get their own pound of flesh. The townspeople of Villisca became suspicious of every person passing through, and authorities became desperate to solve the murders.
I'm not surprised that he had so few leads to go on. The crime, it was both maniacal and methodical at the same time. So on one hand, seems really random. The killer, he didn't even bring his own axe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He also did a bunch of weird stuff with bacon. But then on the other hand, he did seem to have a plan. He knew exactly what he was doing by like hiding in the attic, just waiting there for the family to go asleep. He also used, and this is what we were talking about earlier on, he actually used the back of an axe to kill the 8 people.
Right.
Which seems strange until you realise he was probably did it so the sharp side of the axe wouldn't get stuck or embedded in someone's skull. Mm-hmm. Which to me suggests that he would have been quite lucid to have this kind of thought process. Mm-hmm. Maybe he did it before. So instead of being like some sort of, just in some sort of rage psychosis.
Yeah, yeah,
He knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
But then also, still quite random, a lot of stuff. So.
Yeah, yeah, it's very weird. Pretty much everyone and anyone who passed through Villisca from then on was treated with suspicion. And it was one of these passers-throughers who became the first target of the investigation. A transient named Andrew Sawyer was arrested and interrogated. But apart from being a bit of an odd man with a seemingly unhealthy interest in the case, there was nothing else to tie him to the crime. The most convincing of all the potential suspects was also the only person to ever face actual charges in relation to the murders. The Reverend George Kelly was an Englishman traveling around the States as a minister and just so happened to have been visiting Villisca on the night the crime took place. Now, George Kelly didn't exactly have a great reputation. He was known to be a bit of an oddball, a bit of a weirdo. Apparently, his strange behavior stemmed from an incident in his younger, formative years when he seemed to suffer some kind of psychotic break. He also gained himself a bit of a reputation for acting strangely towards young women, even asking several to pose naked for him. On another occasion, he was accused of peeping through windows. Kelly had arrived in Villisca on the 8th of June to teach at the Children's Day Service, which the Moores attended the next day. He had left Villisca in the early morning hours of the day the crime took place, and had allegedly been overheard telling someone on the train about the Moore family being horribly murdered, despite the bodies not yet having been discovered at the time he was talking about it.
Pretty strong contender there.
Mm-hmm. Over the next several weeks following the murders, Kelly repeatedly contacted the police, various private investigators, and even the extended Moore family. He was constantly bombarding them with letters about the murders, and according to police, he displayed an unhealthy obsession with what had happened. In the end, a private investigator took the initiative and sent a reply to Kelly asking him for details about the crime that only someone there at the time would know, and unbelievably, he got a reply from Kelly. In the reply, Kelly wrote about the murders in great detail, even describing hearing sounds, which led the investigators and police to conclude that Kelly was either a witness to the crime or was involved directly. Either way, they wanted him in custody and set out trying to nail him for the killings. The fact that dozens of people had passed through the crime scene, and even the goriest of details were public knowledge, and an account of the night could easily be pieced together with enough interest, that did completely undercut every and any story Kelly could tell the authorities, but it didn't matter. 2 years after the Villisca murders, in 1914, Kelly was arrested in Washington, D.C. after he'd begun to harass a young woman who'd previously applied for a job as his secretary. He'd sent the young woman explicit material in several letters, and as a result, he was eventually committed to St. Elizabeth's Psychiatric Hospital. On one occasion, after several hours of interrogating, police managed to obtain a confession from Kelly, a confession which he later recanted. In 1917, Kelly was tried not once but twice for the Moore Sillinger killings, and even confessed in front of a jury during the second trial. His first trial ended with a hung jury not being able to decide, but he was finally acquitted at his second. Even after confessing, the jury could clearly tell he was very mentally ill.
I think this is just a case of false confession, where a guy with mental issues was coerced by the police. So Kelly's own lawyer said, Kelly wasn't only a nut, he was a whole carload of nuts, but he didn't commit the murder.
Mm.
So his defense raised objection to the testimony given by the couple on the train who said Kelly told them about the murders in great detail. Before the bodies had been found,
right?
Apparently. The couple, they were an older couple, and during the testimony, they couldn't with 100% certainty say that it was actually on the 10th of June when they were on the train and met Kelly. They couldn't remember the exact date.
Yeah, which is very important for the entire fucking plot of what they're saying. It's like, you have to specifically remember when he told you this.
That's my whole case.
Yeah, that's the whole case.
But all they were sure of, that it was, all they said it was early June. That's all they knew. So the jury were forced to dismiss that piece of unreliable testimony.
As they should.
As they should. The confession that you refer to, it really appears to have been coerced by the police.
Yeah.
Placing pressure on him. So when Kelly, when he was brought in, they spent hours interrogating him. However, even after the interrogation, they brought him back to his cell, where he now had two new cellmates who turned out to be an undercover deputy sheriff and an editor from a local paper who were posing as criminals.
Let a newspaper person into the fucking investigation like as an undercover?
God knows.
That's so... Anyway.
Yeah, it's all very off.
Yeah.
But they were encouraging him to confess because it would go easier for him. They told him that the police had evidence against him and he was dead to rights. But this went on throughout the whole night until Kelly, he was just hysterical and finally just broke down and gave a confession. Now, I don't think that Kelly is completely innocent in all this. He obviously did some other bad things, but
yeah.
I don't think it was him that committed the murders.
No, I don't think so. I mean, he just sounds like he was a creep, but
yeah.
Who had mental issues, but no, yeah. I don't think he did it at all. So the next to fall under scrutiny for the Villisca Axe murders was actually more than one person and involves a bit of a conspiracy theory revolving around a United States senator. Frank F. Jones was the Iowa senator in question and had previously employed Josiah Moore at his hardware store before Josiah broke off to open his own more successful store, taking a lot of business away from Frank F. Jones. There were also rumors flying around town that Moore had had an affair with Jones' daughter-in-law. The affair, however, was never substantiated and was more than likely just gossip. Even without the affair, Jones was known to be unhappy with the competition Moore's store was providing, and certainly wouldn't have been sad to see the back of him, so Frank F. Jones had a bone to pick with our murder victim. Now, the theory gets a little complicated, but we'll try and keep it simple. Over in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in September 1911, a crime with several eerie similarities to the Villisca murders had taken place. The two brutal crimes, separated by hundreds of miles, had enough in common to merit police giving it a proper look. In the early hours of a September Sunday morning, 30-year-old Henry Wayne, his wife, 26-year-old Blanche, and their 2-year-old daughter were all violently smashed to death with the blunt face of an axe. Only the killer hadn't limited themselves to one household like they had the Moores. This time they went next door and did the same to 25-year-old Alice May Burnham and her two young children, who were only 6 and 3 years old. Blame quickly fell on the only surviving member of the Burnham family, Alice's husband AJ, who was severely ill with TB and was absent from the home as he was then living and working as a yardman at a sanatorium over a dozen miles away. AJ was thrown under the bus in the papers as, when he'd been taken to the scene of his family's violent and bloody demise, he hadn't shown the proper correct emotion. So the poor man was condemned for simply being in shock seeing his family murdered. Fortunately, AJ's fellow workers at the sanatorium told the police there was simply no way he could have been responsible for the crime. He was, you know, not only was he far too ill, but he was present at work when the crime took place. Where this is going is, police started linking the Velasca axe murders to a load of other different axe murders that had happened around the country. Two more sickening axe murders took place not long after, with the October 1911 Showman murders in Ellsworth, Kansas, the victims in that one being another family, William Showman, his wife and three children. Next on the chopping block was the Hudson family in June 1912 in Paola, Kansas, with the killings of Roland Hudson and his wife. See, the police thought they were possibly linked, but they couldn't get their heads around the idea of having several similar and extremely violent crimes committed by more than one person. It was weird. There was a lot of axe murders in this time in America in the early 1910s. At least four, and possibly more, and then you had the Velasca murders. Then, 2 years after the Velasca murders, a man named William Blackie Mansfield was suspected of murdering his wife, child, and in-laws with an axe on July 5th, 1914, in Blue Island, Illinois. Now, the lead investigator in that case, James Wilkerson, thought that Blackie could be responsible for the Kansas murders as well as several others. The mirrors being covered was a common factor in several of the murders too. Now, Mansfield actually got himself ruled out as a suspect and even won a lawsuit after he provided payroll records that placed him in Illinois at the time of the Velasca killings. It was then that Reverend George Kelly was looked at as the main suspect, and as we know, that went nowhere. However, Wilkerson never let go of this theory that Mansfield was responsible, and some have speculated that Mansfield may have been contracted to kill the Moors by, dun dun dun, Senator Frank Jones. However, it's pretty unlikely. This theory is one that James Wilkerson even brought up in court, that he believed that the senator had orchestrated murders. The senator in town, Frank F. Jones, he hated Josiah Moore, so he had hired a contract killer named Mansfield, William Blackie Mansfield, to kill the family, but it seemed to have been a theory that fell apart. The only real evidence he had was that Frank F. Jones hated Josiah Moore, apparently. It kind of goes out there. But a lot of people in town believe that Frank F. Jones was responsible. Like, he was too old to have committed the murders, but that he had hired somebody to do it. Even on the day of the murders in Velasca, an attorney in town bumped into Frank Jones and said to Frank Jones, "I'm surprised to still see you running loose." That's how many people in Velasca really believed that the senator was behind the Velasca axe murders.
Crazy. But, yeah. A lot of springs to that theory, but yeah.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't really hold any water.
Yeah, yeah. They were business rivals.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's it. Hmm. I mean, you probably wouldn't want your business rival and his family murdered with an axe.
That's it. Yeah.
It seems like even though they were business rivals, it seems like he still liked him, or like, you know, thought he was
respect
an all right
dude.
Respected.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's some. And now we get on to Paul Mueller. Mm. This is my favorite one.
This is a good one.
This is a really good one. I think this is, I kind of feel like this is the most interesting theory for who was behind the Velasca murders. I think it holds the most water too.
Mm, same.
So, a father and daughter duo, this is in modern day, right, named Bill James and Rachel McCarthy, spent years researching the Velasca murders, along with many of the other murders I've mentioned. And they wrote a book in 2017 called The Man from the Train. I have actually read the book, but I really want to. They speculate in this book that all of the murders were likely committed by a single serial killer. All of the murders, the Velasca murders and all of the other axe murders I've mentioned, was done by the same guy. And the man behind the axe was one Paul Mueller. Now, Mueller had fled the law, having murdered a farming family near Worcester, Massachusetts, after he worked their farm as a farmhand in 1897. He was never arrested for the crime. He successfully evaded the law, went on the run across America. And James and McCarthy, Bill James, Rachel McCarthy, the father-daughter writers, think that several commonalities between more than a dozen incidents put Mueller squarely in the frame as the axe-wielding madman. After he murdered this family in Worcester, Massachusetts, he then traveled across America murdering families with an axe. They allege Mueller chose families that lived near the train routes, hence the name of the book, and all of the attacks were at around midnight, using the blunt side of an axe, and the killer used bedsheets to clean the axe and cover the victims' faces. I think it's an interesting theory. Now let's talk a little bit more about it.
I really like this theory.
Yeah.
I think it's really good.
It's good. So Mueller is a fascinating serial killer. Alleged serial killer. Mm. That's the thing about Mueller, is that like there's very little known about him, which I think is what really makes him interesting, is that you can project so much onto him.
He was a lone drifter going town to town. Like,
there's very little contemporary stuff written about him. He's kind of unheard of by most people. He was born around 1860 in Germany. He was a military veteran. He was a skilled carpenter who didn't speak much English. It's believed he worked as a traveling lumberjack, and so he would have been skilled with an axe. There are many links between the mentioned axe murders. One, the entire family was killed as they slept. Two, they lived near a railroad. Three, the killer was known to watch them for a time before killing them, hiding in a barn or an attic smoking cigarettes. Four, an axe was used. Five, the blunt side of the axe was used. Six, the victims were covered in blankets or sheets. Seven, there were no signs of a robbery in the home. Bill and Rachel believe Mueller could have been responsible for many of the mentioned axe murders, with perhaps up to 60 victims across America. But not another famous axe murder we talked about, which is, we covered an episode on it a couple of months back, the New Orleans axe murders that started in 1918. Probably one of those famous axe murders in all of American history. They don't believe he was responsible for that, even though it would have been in the same time frame. The New Orleans axe murders happened 6 years after the Villisca axe murders. They don't believe he was responsible for that because maybe, just maybe, Mueller went back to his home country of Germany, where there was another axe murder I covered on the That Chapter podcast. Keith, you weren't on an episode. In 1922, one of the most famous axe murders in Europe was the ones at a place called Hinterkaifeck, where an entire family was murdered and the killer was known to be watching them.
And there's also, like, there's another thing as well he used to do with, especially young girls, where he used to pose them after that. So we'd see, like, a lot of these cases, young girls, they'd be posed. But it's interesting, but you mentioned that there'd be around, I think it's like 14 families were annihilated, which I said totaled about 60 victims. And I guess when you think about it, it does seem a little more far-fetched that if these 14 families were killed by 14 separate killers with the same murder weapon, the same signature of staging and posing the bodies of young girls, the bed sheets, and hiding out in the attic. That's way more far-fetched than having just one person do the whole thing.
Exactly. I mean, you have serial killers in modern day times when it's harder to get away with that stuff, like serial killers like Israel Keyes, who traveled around America killing people, who had murder kits all around America, right? And it's actually, he killed himself before we could ever really find out how many people he killed. So I mean, you know, these traveling serial killers are pretty, like, they're more common than you might think. Scarily, it does happen.
Think only sort of recently where, you know, like, if you murder in a state and then go to a different state, it's very rarely that the states would sort of
What I mean. Back in the day of, like, 1912, like,
there'd be no communication.
Communication. There's no DNA. It would have been very easy to do this unless they physically were able to catch you. You could totally get away with this. You could totally be a traveling serial killer. What a job.
I like that, Terry. What a job. It's a murderously job.
You like to live murderously. So last up, but definitely worth of a mention, is suspected serial killer Henry Lee Moore. No relation to the Moore family. He was convicted of the brutal axe murders of his mother and grandmother a few months after Villisca. Again, there were some striking similarities between the crimes, though Moore's guilt in the murders of his mother and grandmother is far from certain. And the reason being he's linked to the Villisca slayings is honestly kind of non-existent. It's just he is believed to have murdered someone else with an axe, so maybe he did this one too.
Why not?
So while the Villisca axe murders remains unsolved to this day, the house still remains. And has a long and storied history of ghostly sightings going on in the 110 years since the awful crime, and has led to an entire industry springing up around the house at 508 East 2nd Street in Villisca, Iowa. There is no shortage of stories of apparitions and nights of terror, especially in the rooms where the murders took place, with several visitors repeatedly experiencing things they cannot explain. And do I have a man who has things he can't explain sitting in front of me?
I would love to stay in this house for a night. I think what makes it...
You already live in a haunted house.
Yeah, no, but I want to pay for it. But I guess, like, what makes it really creepy is the couple that who bought the house in 1994, Darwin and Martha Lynn, they restored it back to its 1912 glory days condition. So they stripped the place of all electricity and plumbing, so the house is, like, just stuck in time. Although it is, like, for $400 a night... Stay there, it's kind of bullshit they don't have plumbing.
Yeah.
You know, how you meant to use the toilet?
But, wait, doesn't they don't even have plumbing?
Well, that's right. Yeah, I read, they said they had no electricity. They took out, they stripped all the plumbing and electricity out of the house. So maybe, I mean, maybe they do have a toilet.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
Well, I don't need to design electricity.
The electricity I can kind of get because it's like, oh, electrical interference, but like plumbing, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a bit much.
Get with the times.
Yeah, exactly. I need to take a shit.
But yeah, it's done out like a sort of historical murder museum. Mm. So you can actually still see the dent in the ceiling made by the axe you mentioned earlier. Which is
when he swung it under the... Yeah,
yeah,
cool.
So that's kind of nifty.
That is cool.
They decided to get all types of people visiting the house, from people, you know, really into true crime, like ourselves, or right up to senior citizens who just happened to arrive by the senior citizen bus that day. But the group that makes up about 90% of their clientele are, of course, the paranormal investigators.
Ooh. Tonight on Paranormal Investigators, we're going to find some weird orbs that are literally nothing at all.
Look at that, a speck of dust. They come in their drones, bringing their Ouija boards, EVP recorders. At one time, they even brought the original axe from the murders into the house in attempts to stir up dark forces that live within these cursed walls. So we chatted about it before in the Ouija episode we did. But in some cases, like, it can be dangerous to, like, you know, pulling back the veil into the next world and opening up that line of communication. You don't know what's going to come true, you know? But, you know, like, in the end, it's just a bit of fun, right?
Yeah.
Just a bit of a laugh, the boys, yeah?
Yeah.
Wrong. In 2014, a ghost stabbed the man in Villisca House.
What?
Well, sort of. So in 2014...
Okay, so he did.
Well, we don't know. So in 2014, 37-year-old Robert Lawson, along with some companions, arrived at the Villisca House to do a bit of overnight paranormal investigating. When he arrived at the house, he meant business. The caretaker of the house recalls Robert sporting camouflage pants and a hunting knife. Yeah, he told the caretaker he was going to give the house a piece of his mind.
Nice. Hell yeah, brother.
To which the caretaker said, all right, have fun with that. And then he just went home. So that night, Robert, he wandered around the house alone trying to get the ghost come out.
Come on, get me. Come on, get me, ghost.
Pretty much. He was just provoking him. Come on, bro. Come on.
It's like stabbing the air.
Yeah. So just before 1 a.m., Robert could be heard calling out for help from the northwest bedroom. They rushed to see what was happening, and there, in the bedroom, they found him on the ground, stabbed in the chest. They immediately called 911, and Robert was brought to the nearby hospital before being helicoptered to a university medical center in Omaha for a more serious treatment.
Mm.
The sheriff's department in Montgomery County, Iowa, said that there was no real indications of foul play, and no charges were being filed. Apparently, it was actually a self-inflicted wound, so he stabbed himself in the chest. Luckily, Robert, he survived the incident, and later he said that the last thing that he remembers was walking around the house trying to agitate the ghosts, and the next thing he remembers is waking up in the hospital. Did he stab himself in the chest to try get some, you know, ghost hunter clout, which is something we all crave, I believe?
Yes, absolutely.
Or did the house cause him to go temporarily manic before a ghost guided his own hands to stab himself in the chest? My guess is he tripped and was too embarrassed to say he accidentally stabbed himself.
Yeah, I think it's probably most likely. Okay, yeah. Well, that's interesting. He's a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Interesting. It's cool, though. It's a cool story. I like that one at the end. And you could say it ended murderously.
Near murderously.
Almost murderously. All right, that's that one. That is the story of the Villisca Axe Murders. Thank you so much for listening to our story of the murder house. That was a good one. Enjoyed that one and enjoyed hearing Keith's stories. By the way, you gotta put motion activated cameras. Put them around your house.
I do. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I should put one up in the attic. That's a great idea.
I think you should. That'd be cool.
Really freak myself out.
Exactly. I'll just set it up for me. I'll watch it. I'll watch your house.
Just watching me. Yeah. I can see you sleeping.
Hello, Keith. What you doing? All right. Here, listen. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, folks, new episode of That Chapter Podcast out every Monday morning, and new videos out on Tuesdays and Fridays. But until the next one.
I'll see you.
There you. All right. Thanks, guys.
That was fun. Enjoyed that.
Yeah.
That was great.
It was very much a last minute change of plan that ended very murderously.
That's it. I don't know why it's so funny.
I know. It's sorry to be laughing, but that sounded weird to me. I said it.
Murderously.
Can we say that for now? That's, can we, that can be our line. It ended purposely. That's going to be a good one. On the way to the Velisca Cemetery for burial.
For a murderously day.
Yeah. And the burial ended murderously. Oh, man, that's going to be my new catchphrase.
Oh, that's good.
Josiah. It ended murderously.
The funeral ended murderously. That's brilliant. So, oh, it's so good. It's so stupid.
It's so stupid. Oh, fuck
me. Like, it's even funnier because, like, the first thing you said made sense as well. Yeah. It's just still funny.
I know, it makes it just sounds like a funny thing to say. It ended murderously.
Oh, man. Maybe it says. Maybe it's the candle. Sucking all the air out of the room. I think we're finding things funnier than they should be.
I know. It's a combination of the beer and there's no oxygen in the tube. We're going to listen back to this podcast and be like, what the fuck are we talking about?
That wasn't funny at all.